My name is Kirsten Barksdale, and I'm the moderator of this session with Jody England Hansen. She's a mixed media artist, occasional empty nester, as are all we are, all of us, right? Mama Dragon, an LGBTQ activist, repatriated Utahn, and God seeker who hasn't figured any of this out yet.
So just quickly to read the abstract. This has been a terrible year, and it's been a glorious year. And in this search for growth and wisdom and knowledge, I don't always like what it takes for me to get it. And so looking at this coexistence of pain and joy, even in the extremes of both pain and joy in personal and spiritual and community life, where is it that I find the truth that Joseph Smith promised in Proving Contraries, and is that possible? So this is just a little bit about a journey of the last year and a half. So a year and a half ago, it was a few months after the policy leak, and the hope for retraction had not come. As Bishop, my husband Mike continued to emphasize the need for every ward member to love and include and serve and embrace everyone. He didn't spend one second of preaching or teaching on anything else, since it was clear that had to be the most important message. And I continued to teach the New Testament course in gospel doctrine, emphasizing the message of love and grace being infinitely more important than any law, especially these Levitical laws that were so prominent. We kept reaching out to those who had trusted us with their story and support them, no matter what. In January, Elder Nelson presented his own version of the policy as being revelation. To me, it was clear from the first moment I heard his talk, this was his personal view. All seeking confirmed for me this was not divine, and yet that was no comfort for many. I could hear wounds being torn open again. A few days later, Mike was told he would be released as bishop before the end of the month. He did not seek this calling. He felt some relief for the release, but we could not help but wonder if there was a connection to him being released less than 4 years into this calling and other recent events, and we may never know. His final talk to our ward was a loving plea. He asked that our ward brothers and sisters stop worrying about being happy, shiny people, but instead have the courage, love, and trust to show their real thoughts, questions, struggles, joys, and strengths so we could know we are all in this together, helping each other. It was hard trying to comfort those who were inconsolable at his release. But Mike was starting a new position at his work, and we both knew we would continue to support and reach out to all of our loved ones, regardless of callings. Then during the following week, another unexpected release, and this time it was me from teaching gospel doctrine. My new bishop told me he would get a substitute for me until he called a new teacher, and that I was not to even teach the lesson I had already prepared for that Sunday. After insisting on knowing why, he said that this was the first thing the stake president wanted him to do as bishop: release me and not have me teach anymore. We sought some answers and endured painful meetings where we heard people we had lovingly served with justify their actions because of gossip and lies they knew were not true. And both Mike and I felt our hearts pierced by deep wounds. In the midst of the wound that week, I felt led to read from Patrick Mason's book, Planted, the chapter about my dad, and from Boyd Peterson's blog, Eugene England and the Future of Mormonism. There was some healing grace, and I thought of what my dad must have felt so many times when he would hear words of condemnation or rejection from the very people he sustained and served with and reached out to and loved. And then I thought of those who were targeted by the policy, those who loved and were often loved by their ward community, who were now specifically rejected by their own. In the midst of this painful week, I had a glimpse of God weeping for us, with us, reaching out to us, even though we fear and hurt each other. That Sunday morning, I wondered if I could ever enter our church building again. How could I go there after there had been such betrayal and such rejection? I thought of Dad's frequent referral to the Joseph Smith quote, "By proving contraries, truth is made manifest," and I saw the impossibility of this. Contraries cannot be proven. Where is the truth in that? And what was clear to me is that contraries just exist. There is only one thing that is true to me. Whatever God is, they are so intimately aware and present that they know and love each of us beyond our ability to comprehend. The contrary's infinite awareness of me inseparably connected with incomprehensible love for me and for each and every one. How is that possible? And the truth manifest. Well, I have no words to describe it. There is no language for this level of oneness. It just exists beyond language. And this is my community, a part of the infinite body of Christ. In this ward, many had cared for me and mine through some of the most difficult times of our life. They had received me and my very different views and methods with grace and love. The few moments of rejection were very rare, which just deepened the wound of this betrayal. Would I allow the fear and the unrighteous use of power or influence by a few people keep me from keeping my covenant to this community? Mike said he would be with me no matter what I decided. I had friends in the area who said I could come and sit with them and that I would be welcome in their own wards. And in my pain, I turned to God. That Sunday morning, feeling these wounds, Christ was there. And here's what I heard in my heart. You hurt. I hurt with you. I am with you no matter what you choose to do. If you don't go to church, I am with you. If you go, I am with you. There are people who need you and people who can strengthen you. And I am with you. I hurt with you. I am with you, always. I went to church in my ward that morning. When people asked me why I wasn't teaching, I told them. Someone complained about me to the stake president, and he ordered the new bishop to release me, and so he did. I didn't worry about being happy, shiny people. That is all I needed to say. There were some interesting conversations, especially since there were so many people who did attend my class who looked forward to the discussion, people who had never heard someone speak so candidly about actions by leaders, people who needed to also share their own pain and feel heard as well. And the person the bishop had asked to substitute and teach in my place was a good friend of mine who was surprised and uncomfortable with the request. He had especially loved being in my class. That day he taught with sensitivity and generosity, encouraging discussion much like I would, and asking for my comments frequently. This was my messy human community bearing one another's burdens, and this became the pattern for months. I was often visiting in Utah, and when here I visited an amazing ward where I saw people practicing having one heart, no matter how confronting, and I relished those visits. When I was home in Colorado, it was hard for me to think about being with my ward, and then I would listen, and there it was. I am with you, wherever you go. If you go, I will help you feed and be fed. And names would come to me, promptings to call this person today or go and visit that person. I was reminded that being of one heart, that embracing each other in our joys and sorrows as we try to make our way through this life does not require a formal calling or permission from a leader or an assignment. The structure of callings and administration helps me practice service, but it is not a requirement. This happened with a certain ward sister who was mourning the death of her father. I visited with her regularly during a very difficult time, and I was there when she was teaching the Relief Society lesson one Sunday. It was on the atonement. She asked people to share personal experiences concerning the atonement, but was getting mostly textbook answers, and she kept looking at me and asked again, "Is anyone willing to share something that happened to you where you saw the atonement working?" I felt it was time to share, so I said, "I love my ward family. I consider this a sacred community where we promise to care for each other no matter our differences, where we witness to each other the promise to follow Christ. I have willingly and gratefully served and been served by my dear sisters and brothers in this ward since we moved here almost 10 years ago, but I am in deep pain. Every time I'm about to enter this building, I stop and pray for strength and direction from God. And this is not because of sin or doubt or lack of faith. It is because there are a few people in my sacred ward family who chose to talk about me instead of with me. I don't know when I come to meetings if I am sitting next to someone who decided to gossip and even lie about me rather than to come to me with questions and concerns, as Christ asks us to do. Christ asks us to go directly to each other and speak and ask and listen so we can learn from each other. By talking about me rather than with me, they are not able to learn from or about me, and I am not able to learn from them, and I am heartbroken. But through this, Christ is there with me, feeling my pain, letting me know there is nothing wrong with how I am feeling, helping me step forward and guiding me. The atonement is not about getting what we want. If that were the case, your father would be alive. My father would be alive. If it were about getting what I want, people would come and speak with me so we can learn to be connected even if we disagree. The atonement is about being with. I have seen it work so intimately these last few months. I have felt God with me, and I am seeking to do the same. Afterwards, several people spoke with me, grateful to hear a story that was similar to their own and relieved to hear it spoken out loud. During this time, a number of occurrences with family and activism caused me to feel that each time I drove to Utah, I was coming home, and each time I returned to Colorado, I was visiting. And I spoke with Mike about this since his new position enabled him to work from almost anywhere in the West. He said he wanted to see how things went for a year or two, but then in May, after more painful and bewildering encounters with our leaders, he agreed it was time for us to go toward the place where we felt needed. And we began packing and prepared to move. In June, during testimony meeting on Open Mic Sunday, my favorite Sunday, while I testified of the blessings I felt in my service as an ordinance worker in the temple, I told our ward we were moving, and I was grateful for the kind thoughts expressed, for those who kept coming and helping, even though the packing and moving seemed to stretch out for weeks as we made several trips to Utah. And suddenly, our leaders stopped suggesting that we needed to do or think differently and just helped us load our stuff into the storage. We were so busy moving and trying to be complete with everything and everyone in Colorado, all while doing all the things that are part of our busy lives, and we just pushed the feelings of hurt and betrayal aside, hoping maybe they would just go away. And things worked out quickly. Our house sold in 2 days, and people showed up and helped. A dear friend in the ward hosted a farewell party in her home where she knew I would feel safe greeting people in neutral territory. The invitation was interesting. It was a card. She did not want us to move. It just said, "Fine, go." And then it had the information for the farewell. Some ward members awkwardly said they were sorry, but then quickly changed the subject before they could say why they were sorry. And a few people who had been present are aware of ways we had been wronged, and yet they had remained heartbreakingly silent about it, began to tentatively try to express love and appreciation for the years we had served with them. And I tried to accept this with some gratitude, but it was hard, and it was a weird time. And the last day in our house, we were exhausted. There was still lots to pack and clean, and we weren't sure how we would get it done. And as we got up before it was light, Mike got a message. His father had died suddenly during the night. And I wondered, how do I help him grieve? How do I convince him to go and do what he needs to do and let me and others take care of lesser things like moving? After notifying family, I sent a message about this news out to our ward family. And soon the house was like an Amish barn raising. There were people who just took charge in each room, clearing out and cleaning up, and some friends who had seemed estranged to us for months showed up and worked tirelessly. They anticipated problems and offered solutions, even to the point of getting another trailer and loading their own truck with the last items and driving it to Utah for us. When Mike was so overwhelmed trying to communicate with his mom and siblings and still finish up the house, they were the ones who could assure him that it would all be handled. And after so much hurt, our final days in this ward were ones where we experienced true religion. The next morning, Sunday, Mike and I sat at a cafe eating breakfast and going over the talks we would give in sacrament meeting that day. And as we sat in the early sun of Colorado, and it really is a beautiful place, we shared thoughts and memories about his dad, about the way some people had surprised us, about not knowing what was next. Good friends from the area were there in our sacrament meeting to hear us. Some hadn't been to church for a long time, But they knew I needed to see loving faces when I spoke for this last time. I set aside the assigned topic. Which was, get this, I'm 60. They assigned me to speak about mothering and nurturing small children. I never took on the assigned topic. So I set aside the assigned topic and I quoted John and Paul, Lennon and McCartney, and thanked my ward for everything they had brought to my life. Mike was raw and generous, and the final goodbyes were emotional. And a few minutes later, we were driving to Utah. The following week, we were in California for the funeral, and Mike spoke of the difficult past with his father, which had become a present of peace and acknowledgement. I sang a solo at the funeral, Amazing Grace. Years before, my own relationship with my father-in-law had been very difficult, but many factors had led us to forgiveness, grace, and a relationship where I could honestly express love for him. I found it interesting to recall that my own stake president that had been so awful had played a small but essential part in that process some years before. Amazing grace. We found a home in Salt Lake City. We look up from our kitchen window to a stunning view of Mount Olympus. When we go to church, we sit in the fourth row in the chapel, where we look out the huge windows that line the front and sides of the chapel and see the same view of Mount Olympus. We wondered about how we would be received in this new ward since we still felt wounded and betrayed at what had happened with our former leaders. Shortly after we moved in, we were interviewed on the news about our feelings about the policy on the one-year anniversary. We wondered if there would be fallout, and instead, several ward leaders thanked us for doing that. I had learned to listen carefully for any spiritual prompting about when my comments might be helpful in furthering conversations of inclusiveness or the gospel of love. Every class seemed to invite such comments. Every meeting was Christ-centered. Every week, someone has spoken with us, asking more questions, wanting to get to know us. The bishop and others thanked me for wearing a rainbow pin to church each week. People have asked for resources for their own LGBT loved ones. My bishop knew I had served as an ordinance worker in the Denver Temple until we moved. In January, he asked if I would be an ordinance worker at the Salt Lake Temple. Now on Thursday mornings at 4:30 a.m., and no, I'm not a morning person, I leave my house while it is still dark and drive down from the mountain towards the temple, watching out for deer on the road, often seeing the moon sitting large over the mountain or over the horizon. I spend the morning working in the temple built by my ancestors, where the ritual story is performed by real people who look like me and is thus more clearly a symbolic, figurative learning experience. When the temple was closed for a few weeks for deep cleaning, Mike and I volunteered. We were willing to climb ladders, so we spent a few hours in the main hall. Mike and another brother anchored two ladders while I stood at the top of one next to a young sister from our stake at the top of another. We cleaned the huge crystal chandelier and spoke about our LGBT loved ones. After a while, she had to leave, and I stayed to finish cleaning and softly sang Amazing Grace in the great hall of the Salt Lake Temple while Mike held the ladder steady. Some months ago, I realized I was still hesitant about this ward, even though they had only shown love and gratitude toward us. I am letting myself belong there now. And in this meditation about best and worst of times, shortly after moving while working hard on campaigns during the election cycle, when I thought things could not be much worse for my culture and community than to navigate through the conflicting messages from the policy, the results of the presidential election created a much greater shift in every aspect of my world. I have been involved in activism for 50 years, and I felt as though all of that has been a warm-up for this time. Trying to interact and speak from a place of love with those who support this administration, and even many of the actions that threaten the safety and existence of myself and nearly everyone I know, has confronted and challenged every promise and practice I have taken on in recent decades. Yet in the midst of this, I have seen so many people, mostly Mormon women, who never thought they would need to be involved in activism, become alarmed or concerned enough to seek reliable, independent information, challenge long-held bias and assumptions, and use their vast experience gained from auxiliary leadership at church. It's really something when there is a huge force of people who know how to get things done without always going through proper channels and not worrying about getting paid for it. And they organize actions and groups and campaigns and training and vigils and rallies, or at the very least a regular personal schedule of calls and writing. I know people who never considered running for office who are now favored candidates. They are showing up and speaking up. At trainings and conferences, many of these new women activists talk of feeling inspired and motivated by their commitment to being Christ-like to all God's children. None are talking about the need to get a leader's or institutional approval or permission, and they are seeing a need and taking action. And I have a feeling they will never do church or family or social or civic involvement the same way ever again. On the day which I thought could never happen in my lifetime, the day of the inauguration, I flew to D.C. to participate in the Women's March and the Mormon Women's Retreat that followed the march. Being among over 500,000 people who came from different concerns, who each had their own opinion about what was needed, who unified in a peaceful yet powerful gathering to speak up and stand for each other, especially those who could not be there, was an experience that was greater than anything I could hope for in my lifetime. Does sinking into a deep wound create a place where new life and new thought can begin? Because the wound has torn everything that came before to shreds. Mike and I have been donating to the Liahona Children's Foundation for a few years now. It is not run by the church, but it is run by church members and focuses on the nutrition needs of primary children and their families under the age of 5. It is run completely by volunteers, using very much the system of visiting teaching. We, for some reason, felt a great desire to go and serve on one of their new tours this summer. It made no sense for us to do this with a packed work schedule and conferences and actions, but we felt an urgent need, and we arranged to go to Guatemala and help there. For 10 days in June, we traveled to remote villages, guided by the volunteer coordinator, Gloria, and her son, Raul, and a former missionary to the area, Chris, was able to join us and be our translator. And we soon felt that they were our own family. We'd gather in local church buildings holding these beautiful children one by one. Some were responding so well to the supplement, and some were there for the first time, and I was alarmed at their condition. And after I weighed and measured them, I held them close and whispered a blessing before I would hand them back to their mother. The mothers expressed their gratitude for our help and told us how they prayed for God's blessings on us each day because our donations were giving their children life-saving nutrients. I wept as I heard them speak of despair when they saw their children in need and they did not have the means to help them. I know what that feels like, to feel that kind of helplessness. They constantly expressed the overwhelming gratitude for blessings from God that had been provided to them. I wondered if we should not have helped by saving money spent on plane tickets and just giving it to the foundation. I felt that we were receiving so much more than we gave. We saw the local volunteers, all women, work tirelessly to visit the people in their area, both LDS and others who were in need, and we walked with them along dirt paths through fields, climbing up steep mountains where the car could not drive to get to homes made of sticks or mud or cinder block. We would listen to their stories of despair turn to hope. We would see how the volunteers had alerted the church members to needs, and even though fellow members had little to nothing, they would gather to help build a tin shack for a woman who lived under a tree, or take food each day to a woman whose husband would take anything else she received and sell it for drugs. Mostly, we would go with them as they made their regular visits. After church on the Sunday we were there, we went down the mountain from a spotless little chapel, driving a short way on a rough road, and then we walked down a steep path to a two-room mud brick house where the branch president lived with his wife and 8 children. Still in our church clothes, we worked to use the few materials and tools we had and filled holes in the stick walls of the kitchen area next to the house and then lined the walls with a tarp. As I smiled at his one daughter and tried to communicate with her, since I have no Spanish, I noticed her young woman's pendant. She had the most beautiful smile. The youngest child played with the little toy we had brought him. I sensed no despair, just love. As we talked about whether we used our funds in the right way to fly down instead of donate, we all felt we still needed to be there in person. I began to see how much these people wanted to be seen, to be witnessed, to see the face of those who would listen to their stories and who would acknowledge they existed. In Guatemala, I saw true religion, pure and undefiled, as I saw these communities come together to bear one another's burdens that they might be light. When they gathered for church, there was no concern about the right clothes or appearance or worthiness. All were seen as the part of the body of Christ, and even the one who showed up so drunk he could barely stand was welcomed and cared for. I met a stunning young woman who had lost her legs to an accident when she was a teenager, and she is a teacher now and is starting a school for special needs children. So much joy and gratitude spilled out of her, I felt like I was wading in it when I was near her. Near the end of our time there, we stopped by the Quetzaltenango Temple and walked around the grounds at sunset. We saw people arrive from long trips on buses. I now knew what their homes probably looked like and could only imagine what it was like for them to come to this building. We had already been welcomed in, even though we were dressed in work clothes and handed clothing, even though we didn't have money, so we could do ordnance work and then sit in the celestial room. And here I saw that this was a refuge in ways I had not considered before. We each had sacred moments in that country where there is so much need, where we felt the presence of rich love, of an abundant God with those who receive them. And I heard it. I am here with you. I am in the wound. I am in the joy. Let go. Heal. We returned home to a full schedule of work and conferences and projects and activism. I still weep when I go to the grocery store and think of the town markets where we bought from the farmers there. I hope more people will help with La Llorona. We plan on returning. Each time I work at the temple, I think of connection that reaches across time and distance. I no longer dwell on what happened in our last ward. There is another election coming up. We are making our home a place of refuge. Much of what we moved to Utah, we have now donated to those more in need in the space that is left. I find healing. The best and worst is here together, and there is no language to speak of it.
No, I'm not going to sing it. It takes 20 minutes of warm-up. But thank you.
I can wait for your touch box session.
Sure, I'll sing it at the end of that.
Okay.
I'm joking. If there's time after questions, I can.
I just wanted to say, Jody, that I, having loved your father and love him so much, and feeling like you've been a daughter of mine, I can't imagine him being prouder of you than I know he is today, not only for the spirit of what you've said, your skill in using language in beautiful ways that he did, but your willingness to be vulnerable and Let your broken heart be visible to us, and also speaking words of healing and love in a world that is so desperate for that, and in a world in which sometimes it's difficult to give it because of the deep hurt, because of the despair that we sometimes feel in looking at what's happening to the world. Your father was a remarkable man, and his shadow, Emerson said, every institution is the length and shadow of one man. He could have added a one woman. Our length and shadow, I think, is one of the things that connects us to the generations as we are able to feel their influence. So I'm very grateful as your friend, as your kind of surrogate father, to see how beautifully you reflect your father and your mother in the beautiful words that you spoke. And thank you also for talking about the Liahona Children's Foundation. I was just in Peru doing the kind of thing you were doing in Guatemala, and there's nothing more beautiful than handling those beautiful children and kissing them and bringing some hope to them and their parents. So thank you for doing that and for all of your beautiful words.
Hi, Jody. I love the idea of LDS mission, meaning the sending of 18 to 22-year-olds around the world to teach and do of Christ. Sadly, however, as I observe in my community, I see what I feel is a lot of inefficiencies, knocking on doors of uninterested people, missionaries walking streets, looking for opportunities, etc. Do you feel that LDS mission would be more productive, perhaps by magnitudes, if it had the look and feel of trips like you described, perhaps distributing elders and sisters in very different ways than we now distribute them around the world, where mission is not done in white shirt and tie, but in t-shirt and jeans or less, and that when these elders and sisters return, they would have more enriching, more dynamic, more moving stories to share with their home communities. Comment generally.
Absolutely. And I'm heartened because I hear more and more about many missions where the mission presidents are doing exactly that, where they see that they have... Their call is more about seeing what is needed in that area, and they fulfill the service over the proselyting, and the service becomes the proselyting. So I would like to see missions become what we did in Guatemala, and I would like to see it happen here in the States too. I think that's the most effective thing you can do. I understand there are missions in California that are doing that, that missionaries went from needing, like, 4 hours of service a week to needing 35 hours of service a week. And none of it is linked to teaching appointments. It's all community service. So I have hope. Yeah. And as far as efficiency, I don't care. I have absolutely no interest in seeing what is most efficient as far as being Christ-like. And so I agree with you. I think when you look at 99% of the time being spent. My husband, all he did was tract on his mission. But the powerful things were not about that. And so I would like missionaries to have a lot more opportunities to interact. When you pick up a child who's 14 months old but weighs less than 12 pounds, and you look in their eyes and you see that you have an opportunity to make a difference to them, your life will never be the same. So I would like to see missions doing something like that. I think it's time for the next session. Thank you so much.